Save big money on your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. I've been skeptical of antidepressant use for quite some time now. Ever since I was an undergraduate, I always saw it as a bit of a palliative measure. It's treating perhaps the symptoms and not the root cause of the problem. And now we have reason to believe that actually they're far more harmful than that. I'm going to look at the evidence because this is really, really important stuff. And of course, it affects a very large number of people. And obviously, don't make any lifestyle changes without consulting a relevant medical professional. I don't want people to go out and do something that could potentially harm them, so please bear that in mind. Nevertheless, there is some important research here that I am qualified to go through and break down, and it's quite shocking, really. And I've known for a while that it's treated the problem very well, but it seems to exaggerate it, or at least that's what the numbers say. So obviously, depression is a widespread issue. Here's a Washington Post article from all the way back in 2013 showing a map of depression rates around the world. And yes, there's a pretty severe problem here. I think it averages out at about 5% of the world's population in 2023 has clinical depression, not just, you know, your subclinical depression, which is still obviously a serious problem, but these are actual clinical diagnoses.
I saw some research a little while ago as well that very liberal women, self-described, were 38% of them had a clinically diagnosed mental health condition, which means that, okay, even more have mental comorbidities that have flown under the radar and haven't been diagnosed by a physician. So the rates of mental illness among people, particularly in the West, particularly people who feel very fatalistic about their future prospects and think everything's some sort of conspiracy against them by the patriarchy or capitalism that has destroyed the climate and will therefore end the world in 10 years, their mental health is not going to be the best.
No, and these sorts of rates are always an underestimate, aren't they, of the mass population, because diagnoses are the bare minimum. There are clearly people out there who just simply haven't had the diagnosis. So it's estimated that about 15% of the adult population will experience depression at some point in their lives, which is massive when you're looking at a global scale. That's for the entire world, as far as I'm aware. So I was drawn to this next study here that I'm going to mention, the main one, by this post-millennial article, which doesn't necessarily characterize it in an accurate way. So it says, new study shows antidepressants use likely to increase risk of suicide. And technically, it didn't show that, although it is something comparably bad. So if we move on to the study itself, titled Antidepressants and Suicide, 7,829 Inquests in England and Wales. And I'm just going to read what they did. They said they analysed a data set of 7,829 media reports of coroner's inquests in England and Wales that mention antidepressants between 2003 and 2020. So obviously, it's imperfect that they used media reports as well, because media reporting isn't necessarily representative of everything that goes on. There are many things that don't go reported. So that in and of itself is an imperfect measure, but I feel like a sample of 7,829 is still good enough to draw some conclusions out of, even if it is a data set that has been shaped by human bias already, but it's worth bearing in mind. So the results suggested the most frequently cited antidepressants were SSRIs and tricyclics, however you want to pronounce it. And the specific drugs most cited were the SSRI drug, citalopram. And just to clarify, an SSRI is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which means that the neurotransmitter serotonin, which is associated with mood, if you have high serotonin, you have a positive mood. If you have low serotonin, you're going to have a bad mood. That's pretty cut and dry stuff. We know that much to be true. And what this does is, rather than generating new serotonin, it stops the serotonin your body naturally generates from being taken back into the cells. It allows it to circulate more, so you'll have a higher level, but it's not artificially producing anymore. It's just stopping the stuff that your body produces from re-entering and not having the same effects. So it's a softer approach than, say, a drug that just increases your serotonin levels, because of course, if it does that solely, then there's going to be a massive deficit, which wouldn't be ideal for treating depression, because you don't want high highs and low lows with someone who's already depressed. That doesn't make any sense.
It's not a peaks and troughs upper. It more creates a sort of homeostasis of the baseline new level of serotonin that your body will be operating off of.
But these percentages are, I believe, the percentage of people who had committed suicide and how many of them were on antidepressants. And it says, of 2,329 cases of death by overdose, 40% were overdoses of antidepressants, which seems like a pretty poorly inbuilt thing, isn't it? That the thing you're providing depressed people to help them, supposedly, is actually the means in which they kill themselves, which is obviously a massive problem. Like, how can you approach a problem where you're meant to be helping someone, but you also provide them the means of killing themselves? It's like saying, oh, you're really depressed. Here, this gun will cheer you up.
Oh, I see you've been talking to the Canadian government recently, Josh.
Yeah, it's such an absurd notion when you actually look at it from this perspective, in that you're giving people the means that they might not otherwise have. Of course, there are other means as well, but obviously we're not going to go into that. It was also 54.9% did not involve any other substances. So it might have been antidepressants and other things as well, push them over the edge in under half of cases. But in half of the ones that were caused by antidepressants, it was solely antidepressants that were used.
Yeah, so there was no other drug dependency. They weren't an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and this is something that doesn't seem to be talked about very much. I saw the media covering this to a certain extent. I know the Daily Mail covered it, although they misunderstood what the study actually showed. And it says the antidepressants most frequently named were amitriptyline. I don't know. I can't say these things. I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I've not learned to pronounce all of them. And citalopram, and a further 929 were overdoses of unnamed medicines, a proportion of which may have been antidepressants. So this is the lowest estimate as well, because of course some of them they didn't have the data for. And they do mention in this, in the summary that they give, that it was primarily reliant on newspapers and is therefore incomplete, and therefore it's not a total picture. But even the window that you do have here is very harrowing. And the conclusions it gives, I think, is a very fair and good summary of what to make of these results. It says, if preventing suicide is the primary reason for prescribing antidepressants, this data set includes several thousand people for whom the drugs clearly did not work. Furthermore, about 1,000 people used the drugs that were supposed to alleviate their depression to kill themselves. Systematic analysis of all inquests would be more informative. Meanwhile, reducing the overprescribing of these relatively ineffective and for some lethally dangerous substances is suggested to reduce suicides. So they're saying that, yeah, well, if you want to reduce suicide, stop prescribing as many antidepressants.
Yeah, it's not a fix-all. And also, and I can say this particularly with women in the West who have been massively overprescribed SSRIs and birth control since their early teens, meaning their hormones are fluctuating. It's not surprising why so many of them, as we mentioned at the start of the segment, have these horrendous and debilitating mental health conditions, because they're reliant on lots of drugs which are messing with their internal body chemistry rather than treating the underlying issues of their lives, whether it be ideology or just lifestyle choices that are making them miserable in the first place.
Mm. And I think that these things have a significant effect on people's psychology, because even though I am a psychologist, sometimes I find it hard to understand where these sorts of people who are like crying over their bowls of cereal.
That video I sent you, yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I find it hard to know where they're coming from. I'm just like, well, things aren't that bad, are they? But maybe their neurochemistry has been altered to such an extent that their sort of normal, their new normal, to borrow a horrible term, is so far removed from what it would naturally be that it causes a natural state of disassociation and lots of detrimental health effects.
Yeah, without getting too personal, I've actually struggled on and off throughout my life with depression, and I would never take a video and post it in front of the world and beg for sympathy. I don't want to be too scorning on that girl, because even though it was a bit performative in the video that we're referencing, which you may or may not have seen, it's obvious that there's a bit of performativity in it if you're putting it on TikTok and you've set it all up. But there is a sense of crushing alienation that you can feel. So it is quite difficult to escape yourself.
I think those sorts of videos, you've got to be a bit more charitable to them, because I think they are a bit of a cry for help, isn't it? It's not someone who's given up. They're posting it. There might be an element of attention, but maybe attention is actually what they need in some cases. I think a lot of the time, depression is motivated by not feeling valued or adequate, and people need validation sometimes. I mean, I'm very scornful of people who look for validation when they don't actually need it on a psychological level, like for vanity's sake. I don't like that. But when it's something that's actually clinically related, then I can certainly understand it.
Yeah, it's not good to crowdsource your self-esteem, particularly when you have people in your immediate vicinity who can give you a deeper connection rather than the broader connection of simps on social media. But if you really have no one, loneliness is a worse killer than a pack of cigarettes.
Mm. No, very true. And we have actually covered a similar sort of thing before on the website. This is my series, Contemplations. This is episode 102, so it's a little ways ago, but it's asking the question, are we a civilization of drug addicts? And it's suggesting the notion, or examining it and the evidence for it, that we overprescribe drugs to try and put a plaster over a problem rather than actually letting it heal. It's like putting a plaster on a hole in a paddling pool, isn't it? You know, it's an imperfect solution to a problem that has to be solved in another way.
It's almost, I would say, almost like trying to bandage up an internal bleeding. Like you're actually not getting to the problem itself. You're putting it on the outside so that it might feel and look slightly better, but then you're still hemorrhaging from within.
It's treating the symptoms and not the cause, basically. So I think there are multiple reasons for this being the case. Obviously, one that does get talked about quite a lot is that Big Pharma, to borrow an American term, has a very significant profit motive to keep this going, because they make a lot of money, and quite often their prices are subsidized by governments as well. So they've got a nice cushy thing going on whereby they've got a guaranteed income. It's not necessarily even up to the market to decide, because of course medical professionals, governments, that sort of thing are the ones deciding what gets bought and from whom.
Yeah, you're creating your own dependent customer base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, there's also something that's perhaps more forgivable, in that medical practitioners have limited resources, don't they? I think that's fair to say. And although I don't agree with this, you can sort of understand why they say, okay, well, I've seen this person with depression and I've given them something to treat them, like a drug. And although I don't necessarily agree with that and that it might not be appropriate in many cases, they're at least trying to do something about it. And they can kind of tick off and say, well, I've seen this person, I've given them treatment, when actually I think more dedicated care would be ideal. But of course, there aren't enough medical practitioners to give that level of care, and not enough resources dedicated to it, which I think might actually be a bit of a mistake, because of course, you can't really put a price on a person's mental well-being, can you? Because as long as you're content, you don't necessarily need nearly as much material resource, do you?
I think so. I think it's a threefold issue there. Number one, as we just said, Big Pharma likes their customer base. They want to keep you drugged and dependent. And they obviously are in the same cohort of consumerist corporations who want miserable people so that they need to fill their homes with eclectic possessions to give themselves some sort of purpose in life. A bit like Ed Norton in Fight Club, right? Then there's also the factor that the same medical practitioners, particularly in the UK, that work for the NHS and constantly complain about overtaxed resources, will vote for increased migration and increased state entitlements, which are stressing the system, meaning that there are fewer resources for more people. And then also, these medical practitioners as well, if they are buying the drug them up orthodoxy, are not prescribing other lifestyle changes, which would save them resources in the long run, such as diet, exercise, mm-hmm. talk
We'll be therapy. Getting onto all of the alternatives later on. Obviously, not prescribing anything to anyone, but these are all going to be useful things that people can do, even if you're not, you know, clinically depressed. Yeah. They're just good things. But I wanted to touch on this other study that it's been around for a while, but it has caused a storm because it is kind of the gold standard, even like the platinum standard of research here. So it's titled The Serotonin Theory of Depression, A Systematic Umbrella Review of the Evidence. And an umbrella review is like the highest review of the scientific literature. So it's looking at like meta-analysis, systematic reviews, and it's compiling the findings of all of those, which are themselves reviews of the literature. And it is also worth mentioning here that it's looking at the serotonin hypothesis of depression, which suggests that a deficiency or imbalance in the level of serotonin in the brain is the key factor in the development of depression. So the theory is that when the level of serotonin is low, this can lead to a range of mood disorders, one of which is depression, and that drugs that increase the availability of serotonin will help treat this. And this is just one of many theories, though, of the cause of depression. It's not necessarily just because it's the dominant one doesn't mean it's the only explanation of it. And I think that it's been given undue significance relative to the actual scientific evidence, at least to my understanding and, well, seemingly the understanding of this very good research paper.
I think the hope is that if chemical imbalance is the predominant cause, and that's the easiest one to fix, and so people are buying into this because they hope, with the best of intentions, mm-hmm. that they can shortcut their way to ameliorating depression for many people.
Well, yeah, taking a pill or two every day is a lot easier than making significant lifestyle choices, yep. isn't it? And you can't really hold it against people for wanting it to be true, mm-hmm. even though it's not. I mean, particularly if they're depressed, a bit of hope is a rare thing. Yep. So certainly don't blame the people going along with this from the patient side of it. But I feel like some of the health professionals should know better, really. And they looked at 17 studies, 12 of which were systematic reviews and meta-analysis. One was a collaborative meta-analysis. One was a meta-analysis of large cohort studies, and cohort studies are like a medical thing, looking at drug interventions. One systematic review and narrative synthesis, and one genetic association study, and one other umbrella review. So it's like an umbrella review of an umbrella review.
Yeah, very comprehensive.
So yes, it couldn't be any better, really. I couldn't give this study enough thumbs up for its thoroughness. And it says that the main conclusion here, without looking into all of the details because bore you to death, it says the main areas of serotonin research provided no consistent evidence of there being an association between serotonin and depression. No support for the hypothesis that depression is caused by lowered serotonin activity or concentrations. Some evidence was consistent with the possibility that long-term antidepressant use reduces serotonin concentration, which right. is, again, a very harrowing finding that the thing it's meant to actually be helping, it lowers. And yes. one thing that I've seen many political commentators get wrong about this is they're saying, oh, well, the sort of neurochemical explanation of how the brain works is wrong. And that's not true. It's not that neurochemicals don't have any effect on how the brain works. It's simply that in this specific instance, depression seems to be far more complicated than one neurotransmitter, basically.
And also the existing medical technologies we have prescribed to treat it are insufficient in doing their job.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, but what we've seen so far, obviously, just to summarize the evidence, is that, yes, it lowers serotonin, which, of course, will lower your mood in some cases. And it also provides a means of people to kill themselves, which is the two worst things you could give someone who is depressed. Mm. And the fact that this isn't like a front page story, considering it's a life or death situation for a significant number of the population, you think, oh, this would be important. But no. Instead, there's loads of fanfare over silly stories that, in the grand scheme of things, aren't nearly as consequential as this, but because it's not quite as glamorous, perhaps it doesn't get as much recognition, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And rather than being all glib and saying, you know, that the world is going to, what's the polite way of saying it?
Pot? Not,
yeah, it's going to pot. That's much better. There are lots of things that can be done to help people who are depressed, either clinically or not, or just people who are normally functioning. These are still useful things that you can do. And I think one thing that I'm quite big on is cognitive behavioral therapy. I think that this sort of talking therapy is very good because it conceptualizes depression as a natural response to bad ideas or lifestyle choices, which I think meshes quite well with my worldview. Obviously, some people might have different instances. There may be perfectly reasonable reasons why they're depressed. I mean, if you've just had a catastrophic accident where your family's died, I don't think it's abnormal to be depressed about that. Mm. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable. And that's another thing as well, that medical professionals are too willing to medicalize normal human behavior.
Yeah, I think you have to treat particularly harsh emotions like rage and depression as a immune reaction by your soul, to put it in a not glib way, but a bit of a metaphysical way. In that,
it's a fair way to put it, though.
Yeah, if you don't blame your immune system for flaring up and making you bedridden when it's fighting off a flu, because it's just the symptom of the flu means that it takes a lot of energy out of you. And so if you've had a bereavement or a breakup or a divorce or something like that, then you shouldn't blame yourself for feeling terrible about it. Mm-hmm. You're currently parceling through all the reasons why those events came into being so that you don't repeat the same mistakes.
I have a sort of idea of what a healthy person is someone who experiences the full spectrum of human emotions. You don't stunt yourself in one area. I don't think being happy 24/7 is actually healthy for you. And I also don't think it's possible, of course, because where there is a peak, there is a trough. So there's always a bit of give and take there, but that should just be expected. That's what life is like, isn't it? That's what life is. You can't always have it going well for you, but that also means that when it does go well for you, you appreciate it all the more. Mm. So there's a sort of yin and yang to it in a nice way that is kind of reassuring, that the badness makes the good better. And that's my kind of optimistic take on it. That's a rare point of optimism for me. But yeah, CBT just focuses on identifying these bad ideas and changing these sort of negative thoughts and attitudes that might be maladaptive and unhelpful. And they try and get people to make positive changes in their own life to mitigate these sorts of things. And this is also good, I think, because it makes people think about their mental health problems as something that they can actually solve themselves, that they can work on in their own time. And it gives them a bit of power. You're not reliant on some medical professional just to sign off on a drug. The authority is entirely in their hands. You're the one that's taking an active role in making yourself better. And I think that that's actually far more healthy for people to have a role in their own recovery, because it makes them feel like they have greater autonomy over their own lives, which for someone who's depressed is huge.
If I might make a suggestion as well, and this is no substitute for clinical interventions for people that are suicidal, but if, considering the long waiting lists we have in the UK, or the costliness of therapy overseas in places that don't get it subsidized, one thing you can do as a considerate friend is at least learn some of the basics of the principles of CBT, or just practice a compassionate form of Socratic questioning and lend people a listening ear, because in lieu of some clinical intervention, people sometimes just need someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm. It does really help. Even if you talk to someone and you get nothing out of it other than just expressing how you feel, that's still something valuable, isn't it? And just as I've got the opportunity here, I wanted to highlight one sort of line of thinking that might be in keeping with the CBT line of thought that I've always found just in my anecdotal experience, because, you know, being a psychologist, people ask me for help and I'm always happy to do it, because it's a way of giving back to people that makes me feel good as well. So everyone wins. But this line of argumentation, I think, is very powerful in that if nothing matters and your life is worthless, why can you not help but care about it? Doesn't that suggest that if you're feeling bad, that you do care, and that it's not all for naught, and that if you do care, you know that you have thoughts, values, and things that you should be pushing towards to feel better? And I would say that you don't really believe these things to be true in your innermost core being because you feel bad about the world. If you're truly indifferent about the world and yourself, then it wouldn't trouble you. And that means you do care, and therefore you should do something about it to make it better, because that's how you get better, is work towards making these things you care about better in the first place.
Yeah, you can't grieve a loss or lament the fact that you don't have something if nothing matters.
And I think these sorts of, and that's just one example of many, where you can talk through the problems and it gives people a new perspective on it and makes them realize, oh yeah, actually, well, of course, yeah, that seems really obvious. But one of the problems with depressed people is that they get stuck in these modes of thinking that are maladaptive for them, in that it's almost like a well-trodden path, in that it's easier to go through that than the tall grass either side, but sometimes it's better for you to do that. Mm. And obviously there are other things as well, which are very important. Exercise, that's been shown to have a good effect on your mood and has been shown to help reduce the symptoms of depression and sometimes alleviate it entirely. Another thing that is perhaps a bit hippy-dippy and might not appeal, but is still very good, is mindfulness meditation, which just focuses on developing a self-awareness. I think this is just an important skill to examine your thoughts and behaviors, and is a good complement to CBT. It doesn't have to be, you know, sitting on a mat with your legs crossed. You can just sit and think about what you think about the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that every healthy person should do this. You don't need to necessarily be some sort of Buddhist about it. I think just thinking about how you think about the world and trying to solve the problems and work on yourself is something that everyone should be doing by default all the time.
It's a secular form of prayer, and it's worked for plenty of traditions throughout history. So,
and another thing that quite often gets overlooked is that you can have vitamin deficiencies and nutritional deficiencies that do have significant effects. So omega-3 is very good for you in that respect. Vitamin D, the B complex vitamins, these all help alleviate the symptoms of depression.
If I can endorse magnesium as well, just because it helped me sleep when I was going through a bit of a rough patch recently. So I'm no medical expert, but it doesn't seem to do you any harm. It seems to have some benefits.
Yeah, but these are all helpful things that you can do. And obviously, I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I have read a lot of the clinical research. I do have a good understanding of it, at least in my opinion. If you are suffering from depression, perhaps these are some ideas to take to your therapist or your clinician or whoever you're seeing. Say, well, maybe I want to try something else. This drug therapy isn't working for me, or I'm concerned that it's going to make me worse. Are there other things that you can try? And I think that this should be a substrate for you to have a constructive discussion with professionals, or at least just if you're not suffering from it, just being aware of this is very important, because you can help direct people in the right direction, as well as provide as much support and be as effective as you can. And I can't emphasize enough how important this is.
Thanks for watching that segment from the podcast Lotus Eaters. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to find more of what we do and fancy exploring a bit, you can go to our website, lotuseaters.com, and subscribe to become a premium member for as little as £5 per month, which will give you access to all of the excellent work that we do. For instance, a recent hangout where Carl and Callum spoke about grooming gangs. We do live hangouts pretty regularly on the website, and they just go through the timeline of these grooming gangs. If you'd like to find more of what Carl does on a general day-to-day basis, you can follow him on Getter at Carl Benjamin. Thank you and take care.
Saving money on your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.